Good evening. You're listening to special election coverage on KRBD Ketchikan. My name's Layla Carey, and I'm here with guests from both sides of the ballot Measure 1 debate. For the next hour, we'll be discussing that proposition, also known as the Stand for Salmon Initiative, and taking your questions. First, let me introduce our two guests. Speaking for the measure is Lindsay Bloom of Juneau. She's a second-generation Bristol Bay gillnet captain. She's fished in the bay for 15 years before anchoring down in southeast with her family to continue salmon fishing. Bloom has a master's degree in sustainable development, worked with Alaska fishermen, fishing organizations, tribal organizations, businesses, and nonprofits. Her focus is on young fishermen and fish habitat policy. She's currently the director of Alaska Policy for Salmon State. Thanks for joining us. And speaking against the ballot measure is Jaylene Kukesh, the Sea Alaska Corporation Vice President, General Counsel, and Corporate Secretary. She drives Sea Alaska's legal activities and public policy priorities, which include legislation and regulations to advance Alaska Native interests and addressing shareholder issues. Kukesh has a bachelor's degree from Stanford University and a Juris Doctorate and Certificate of Indian Law from the University of New Mexico School of Law. She's a Sea Alaska and Doyon shareholder, an enrolled member of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska, and a member of the Alaska Bar Association and the District of Columbia Bar Association. Kukesh is originally from Angoon and lives in Juneau. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
And this is a call-in show, so if you have questions for our guests, please call 225-9655 or 1-800-557-5723. First, though, we'll have an opening statement from each of our guests, and we'll start with Lindsay.
Thank you, Layla. Thanks for having me tonight, bringing us here together, and thanks, Julian, for doing this as well. And good evening, Ketchikan, Prince of Wales, Southern Southeast Alaska. It's great to be here and to have the opportunity to speak with you all tonight. I'm here to speak in support of Ballot Measure 1, not as a mouthpiece for any particular industry or environmental group or anything else, but simply to get a chance to connect with KRBD listeners, Alaskan to Alaskan. I'm here as a mom, a fisher, and hunter with a freezer blessedly full of deer, moose, fish, and berries. My family, just like every family in Alaska right now, has a mortgage to pay. We have a permit loan for commercial fishing, childcare expenses, et cetera. And so, like all of us, I have a really strong personal interest in seeing our economy thrive and rebound from its current state and thrive for years to come. On November 6th, you'll be faced with a critical decision at the polls when you're asked to vote on Ballot Measure 1, the Stand for Salmon Initiative. I often get asked, well, what does it mean if I vote yes, and what does it mean if I vote no? From my perspective, a yes vote means that you agree with a very large movement that has unified tens of thousands of Alaskans to put this initiative on the ballot, who are seeking to update our salmon habitat permitting law that was written in 1959 at statehood. You're voting yes because you want strong, healthy salmon fisheries in the future, and you want a law in place that truly balances fish habitat protection with responsible resource development. On the other hand, a no vote means that you want to stick with the status quo, that you trust that those that develop in our waters in Alaska, most of whom are going to be, private for-profit corporations from outside the state, often multinational, that they're going to protect our salmon habitat, not because there's a law that tells them to, but out of the goodness of their hearts. And that's what I think a no vote would be. I'd like to tell you a little bit more about why, with tens of thousands of other Alaskans again, my family of multiple generations of fishermen will be voting yes in November. Alaska is the last place in the United States that still enjoys healthy and sustainable salmon fisheries. We can't simply manage the harvest and then expect our salmon populations to remain strong. We also have to have strong salmon habitat management in place, especially during times like these of where we're seeing low returns throughout the state. In tough times, the single most important thing we can do is provide healthy habitat for salmon to come back to. The problem is that Alaska's current fish habitat protection and permitting law is too general and too vague to truly balance sustainable fisheries and responsible development. Under the current law, the Commissioner of Fish and Game is directed to issue a fish habitat permit as long as the project proponent can provide for the proper protection of fish and game. That's the term that's used, the proper protection of fish and game. And the law, Title 16 right now, there's about a paragraph that sort of explains the commissioner shall issue a permit for a diversion of work, a dam, you know, et cetera, as long as it provides for proper protection. The current law doesn't have a definition of what proper protection means. And so I see that as being a very politically driven process. And it doesn't provide certainty or accountability in the system. So during last legislative session, there was testimony from the Department of Fish and Game, and habitat managers and biologists testified and identified specific challenges that they face when trying to protect fish habitat under the current law. Specifically, they said that they have a really hard time with enforcement authority, that they often have to implement workarounds to assert their jurisdiction over certain fish-bearing water bodies that aren't in the anadromous catalog, and that they don't have science-based standards upon which the decisions have to be based. The current law is a far cry from a rigorous permitting system, and the status quo is simply not an option if we want to maintain healthy salmon fisheries in this state. So as a solution, ballot measure one updates the law that exists with proactive measures that strengthen the law and buffer us against what has happened to salmon populations in the Pacific Northwest as Alaska continues to grow. Specifically, ballot measure one creates habitat protection standards and defines the proper protection of fish and game. It creates a two-track permitting system to ensure that projects that pose little threat to fish habitat get a minor permit and are processed quickly, but projects like, you know, the Pebble Mine are put on a major permit track and receive more scrutiny because they have the potential to damage Alaska's salmon. Third, it requires public notice for all permits that are issued under Title 16. It expands Fish and Game's ability to protect fish habitat by assuring that they have authority over all of Alaska's salmon-bearing waters, and it establishes a standard of care for fish habitat that encourages and incentivizes responsible development practices. Ballot Measure 1 is an effort to get Alaska ahead of the curve and to put strong fish habitat protection policy in place before we start making decisions that we can't take back. Contrary to what you've been hearing on the TV and the radio, Measure 1 is not asking voters to choose between having healthy fisheries or having a strong economy. That is a totally false choice. Rather, Measure 1 ensures that we will have a future that envisions both smart and responsible economic growth from all economic sectors and maintain healthy salmon runs for future generations. That is something that hasn't happened yet in any other states or places where salmon, which are now extinct or endangered throughout their range, that hasn't happened yet. And Alaska really has, we have the last chance to get it right for sustaining our wild salmon runs.
Thank you. And you may have heard a slight giggle just then, and that's because we're having difficulties with our attempt at live Facebook living this event. Apparently the image is flipped on the side. Deb is attempting to fix it. So if anybody out there is watching on Facebook Live, please be patient. It's our first time. So, and Jaylene, your opening statement.
Yes. Thank you, and thank you for having me. Again, I'm Jaylene Kukash. I'm with Sea Alaska Corporation, and I also am the co-chair for Stand for Alaska, because I feel very strongly about this issue personally, but also, thankfully, the company that I work for, Sea Alaska Corporation, also has taken a position in opposition to Prop 1. And we're opposed to Prop 1 and have joined the Stand for Alaska Coalition for a couple of reasons, primary reasons. First is we're opposed to the process that created this proposition. It was developed in our mind by one set of interests, and in our experience in Southeast Alaska and in Alaska, we need collaboration and balance to address our very difficult and conflict-ridden resource issues. And secondly, because it was not created in a balanced way with a balanced approach, the proposition will negatively impact our rural communities and our Alaska economy. So I guess I would tell people, first off, to look past the name, Stand for Salmon. We all stand for salmon. We all support salmon. I grew up on salmon. I have salmon as a regular part of my diet. My family lives in Angoon, and our rural communities and all of our communities are very dependent on salmon. But I do ask you to look past the name Stand for Salmon. A problem like low salmon runs requires input from many interests at various levels of expertise. And I'm talking environmental, cultural, economic, community, government, regulatory agencies, science, traditional knowledge, just to name a few. And that didn't happen in this instance. There's no comprehensive analysis of how the current statutes and their implementation are failing that would help back up this proposal. There's no examples that I've heard of as adverse effects to important anadromous fish habitat from projects that are permitted under the current structure. And I have to ask, does this measure actually target the real source of the problem? Many scientists out there agree that it's the marine environment and not the freshwater streams that are the source of the problem. You're having rising ocean temperatures, salinity issues, and there's the allocation of the fish are another issue where the fish aren't even making it to the stream in the first place due to the catch outside of the freshwater systems, bycatch issues or other allocation issues. So in our view, this doesn't even necessarily target the problem. You have recent op-eds that were published by former state regulators, scientists, former state officials that very clearly state that this would replace Alaska's scientific process for identifying, studying, and permitting fish habitat with these new untested regulations. There was a recent op-ed in the Anchorage Daily News as well from former attorney generals saying that this proposition disrupts the balance between the constitutional balance between protection of our resources and development of our resources. There was no opportunity in development of this for public comment, for hearings, or for review by regulators or independent scientists. So I guess in terms of opposition due to the process, our concern is who was at the drafting table. I know that none of the interests that I represent were asked to comment on or provide input into the drafting of this proposal. It's not balanced, in my view, having read through it and with my legal background, understanding how statutes are written and how to interpret those. It doesn't provide a balanced consideration and is very much environmentally focused, anti-development focused, and appears to have more outside interests involved in the drafting and development of this process. And the interesting thing is the proponents do want to see more public input in the permitting process. I would have liked to see more public input in developing this proposal. So what you have is the results of this approach is that, yes, it will shut down, in my view, or significantly delay or add cost to large projects like mines, oil and gas projects, timber projects. So yes, those large projects will be delayed and impacted. But worse than that, our community projects, infrastructure projects in our rural communities will be impacted. And our rural communities and our small communities in Alaska can't afford those delays and extra costs of this proposal. One of the main problems is that there is a presumption in this proposal that all waters are anadromous, anadromous meaning fish-bearing. The presumption that all waters are anadromous will require them to get a permit unless they can get the commissioner to agree that it is not anadromous, which they have to apply to the commissioner for such determination. So, and this doesn't just apply to developers and large companies. This applies to any landowner, and that's our concern. I'm concerned as a citizen who owns property. in a rainforest where there's lots of water running through my property. And I'm also concerned, as part of management of Alaska Native Corporation, and our Alaska Native Corporations in Alaska own 44 million acres of private property. And our economic development projects and initiatives will be impacted by this. There are multiple, or as the Supreme Court said in its decision when it was reviewing the proposition, they actually said there are a plethora of undefined terms in the initiative. This includes terms such as significant adverse effect, de minimis effect, substantial damage. There's terms throughout, and also there's different permitting levels, major permits, minor permits, general permits. And for me, as I read through it, these terms are very important and need to be defined, and the permitting structure that applies to every activity is not clear. And as a voter, I don't want to vote yes on something where the terms are not clear and the implications are not clear. This proposal doesn't just affect Department of Fish and Game. It affects the regulatory management that's handled by the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, the Alaska Department of Transportation, and Alaska Department of Natural Resources. All of these additional steps will cause extra costs and extra delays. And one of our concerns, especially, like I said, in rural communities, but one of the big concerns is a lot of the projects in Alaska, including highway projects, bridges, airports, are tied to federal funding. And federal funding has a timeline by which you have to spend that money for that project. If we have these additional delays and reviews for permitting, as well as additional delays for public comment and challenges to final determinations by the commissioner, all of it just results in more delays, more costs, and possible loss, in my view, of federal funding for some of these projects. So I guess I just see impacts both large and small. It's impacts to large development, but also in our small communities. And I do want to say that I know a lot of people feel very emotional about the idea of Stand for Salmon and the terms of Stand for Salmon. And I ask you to look beyond the name and really read the fine print. This proposition is 8 pages long. It has 14 sections of statute in it. It's very complex, and while I support the idea of citizen-sponsored propositions, I think this is too complex of an issue to do by proposition. And we at Sea Alaska are much more supportive of addressing this kind of issue together with all interests at the table in a collaborative approach, and we'd be happy to push forward a salmon summit or some process where we do address the problems, because it's not like we're saying we don't think that there is a problem with some of our salmon runs, but we should address it collaboratively and not with just one set of interests at the table.
Okay, thank you very much. Was there anything in there that you wanted to respond to?
I wanted to respond to everything in there, but I think if I may, I might just respond to the piece that you ended with. And I guess maybe a question back to you is, like, I guess I'm just not clear what a collaborative, balanced process to write a law might look like. Because mm-hmm. in this process, you know, the first time that I personally was part of a conversation about this was during the transition team when the Walker administration first came into office. And they put together a incredibly diverse committee full of, you know, sport fishing, commercial mm-hmm. fishing, seafood processors, just, all, you know, fish related people, subsistence users, tribal representatives from all throughout the state to spend 3 days in a room together and come up with recommendations for the incoming administration. I had the privilege to be part of that process. Mm-hmm. The number one priority recommendation that came out of that was to define what a fish first policy for Alaska is. There were specific recommendations that match and inspired the science-based criteria that are in the ballot initiative. After that, there was a multi-year process with the State Board of Fisheries in which stakeholders from throughout the state of Alaska, including tribal representatives, again, sport fishing, dip netters, commercial fishermen, came together and said, what unifies us and what we are all concerned about is having solid protections for our habitat. That was, a multi-year open public process mm-hmm. with public comment, public hearings throughout the state in which people were able to weigh in on what they thought, you know, Title 16 should be and should look like. That resulted in a unanimous letter that went from the Board of Fish to the state legislature and said, mm-hmm. we've studied this. We've brought in the Habitat Division. We've brought in the experts. And with unanimous agreement, we believe that this law needs to be updated. Mm-hmm. Specifically, there needs to be science-based criteria to define mm-hmm. the terms, which right now there is not. And secondly, there needs to be public notice. Mm-hmm. At that point, there was 2 more years of legislative session and public process in which thousands of Alaskans weighed in. Mm-hmm. They did. Thousands of Alaskans weighed in. I sat through all the hearings and I heard them and I read what they wrote.
Because of all the controversy, it didn't go anywhere. Because it was very one-sided.
What went anywhere in the state legislature last year? They're dysfunctional. You know, it was dysfunctional and it didn't go anywhere. That's true.
But you are listing interests, and yes, there are a lot of interests, but I hear mostly commercial fishery interests there at the table. And what I'm concerned about, and believe me, we support fisheries. We know the fisheries is an important part of our economy, but there's other facets of our economy that will be very significantly impacted by this. So while I appreciate the importance of the fishery economy, and I'm a native person, so I understand the importance of subsistence fishery. And actually, I take issue with a lot of the commercial harvest that impacts our subsistence fishery. I take very big issue with that. And I have an issue with the fact that some of our fish can't even get to the streams because of the commercial harvest. But there are other interests in this state in terms of economic development that we need to be considerate of as we define these resource regulations and this resource-related public policy. And I support maintaining our fisheries, but we have other facets of the economy that were not at the table and that will be significantly impacted. We believe that there's a way where we can sit down and actually address what is actually happening to the fisheries without shutting down other parts of the economy. And this just goes too far. And I'm not saying that Title 16 can't be updated or shouldn't be updated. For 10 years, I was in D.C. That's where I started my career. And I made a living for that time drafting legislation, amending legislation, more so amending it because things need to change over time. And so I do believe that there is a need for constant reevaluation assessment of legislation and regulations, but I don't agree with one aspect of our economy being part of that discussion. And maybe you disagree with that, but I didn't see this proposition until it was proposed for the ballot. And then the process that was before the legislature, it didn't get anywhere because it was pretty much the same language, and it's too one-sided. And there was a recognition right off the bat that there was too much work that needed to be done on it to have it move forward.
Okay, so I'm going to end this part of the debate because, I mean, the process was the process. We're here. It's on the ballot. We're going to vote on it. So mm-hmm. One thing that was submitted to me ahead of time, a question from a listener, is why are or aren't the current protections for salmon adequate? Why did they need to be updated? And this time we'll go ahead and start with Jaylene.
Well, I actually don't believe they're inadequate. Yes, everything can be improved for everything that we do in life or in regulation. FAQs that state agencies and regulatory agencies responded to, and one of their responses is they do believe that the fisheries are adequately protected. And this is just one aspect of the protection of fisheries. My company, Sea Alaska Corporation, actually also operates under the State Forest Practices Act, which is a whole other set of regulations that deals with resource development, and we have to get permits under there. There are protections within that act as well And there are other protections from many other statutes in the state of Alaska that deal with fisheries that aren't specifically to this particular section or Title 16. So my view is that, yes, they are adequately protected. Can we do better? Yes. But let's talk about that and how we can do so in a balanced way.
Okay. And Lindsay?
Yeah. No, I mean, I agree with what you said. And I'm glad you brought up the Forest Resource Practices Act, because like I said, when we started thinking about like what would a fish first policy for Alaska look like, and we wanted to look at, well, what exists on the books now and is it adequate, and to really analyze that. And the Forest Resource Practices Act is actually one of the model policies that we were able to look at and be like, oh, you know, they basically have a presumption of anadromy in there. If it looks like fish habitat, it's going to be considered fish habitat. They have very clear criteria around buffers, stream crossings, log dragging, things like that. And we were like, this is the kind of law that should be applied across the state so that we don't have to worry in other places where they're not operating under FERPA about impacts. So, yeah, I agree. FERPA is a sound policy. I think it's worked really well to strike the balance that you spoke about. And I think what this ballot measure does is seeks to apply those standards across sectors and across the state.
But the problem is it's not just,
No, that's okay. Go ahead.
The problem is it's not just going to apply those standards to just timber or just other development. You as a private property owner who maybe needs to put up a retaining wall on your property, it's not clear to me whether it's going to be, you're going to have to get, clearly it's going to fall under an impact on waters if you need a retaining wall to deal with a stream or waterways on your property. It's not clear to me then if you're going to have to get a minor or a major permit for that. There is a response from one of the state regulators that, in their view, a retaining wall would require a major permit, which is very strenuous for a private property owner to have to go through that process. So while I agree that for development purposes like timber and major projects that there's some standards that need to apply and to preserve the fish habitat, which is why we have the Timber Practices Act, that it shouldn't apply so aggressively that it affects us as private property owners.
Okay. And did you have a you grabbed a piece of paper?
I do. So. I mean, I have the ballot initiative in front of me, and so I just very respectfully disagree with what you said. I don't see any way in which the language in this measure could be interpreted to mean that a retaining wall would be significant adverse impact and require a major permit.
Well, because significant adverse impact is not defined, though.
Specifically, it says significant adverse effects where an activity may impair and degrade natural habitat characteristics, interfere with or prevent spawning, rearing, and migration of anadromous fish, result in conditions that cause mortality of anadromous fish in any life stage, etc. Those are significant impacts. It is defined. That's exactly what that says.
But the definition creates
Hold on.
More questions.
Hold on.
Yeah.
Okay. So it is defined. And a retaining wall, very clearly, by the language that's written in the ballot measure, would not go under a major permit. I think that that is a scare tactic to say that. Also, for individual Alaskans who are private property owners like myself and like yourself, as you've mentioned, there are a lot of tools that Fish and Game has based on the initiative to make to streamline the process. For example, they have the ability to issue general permits for activities that happen often regularly on the daily in specific geographies in Alaska. For example, they could issue a general permit for motorized vehicle crossing in Bristol Bay region, for example. And then that would just be something that was a blanket authorization, and individual people wouldn't have to worry about going to the department every time to get a permit for that. They could very much do that for other activities that would have very minimal effects on salmon habitat, and that general permitting authority is retained in the initiative so that they have that flexibility.
Okay, go ahead.
And again, it's not clear to me what qualifies for a general permit, who has to apply for that. And then you should know that under this initiative, there are multiple steps for public comment that are going to delay a decision. There is an ability for any interested person That can mean somebody in Massachusetts. Any interested person can ask for a public hearing. Any interested person can ask for a reconsideration of decision. And that means a reconsideration of decision to determine that a stream is not anadromous, reconsideration of a decision that something requires a minor permit, reconsideration of a decision that something requires a major permit, and reconsideration of a decision on a general permit, and reconsideration of a decision on whether those permits should be issued. So if any interested person can cause all those delays, that makes me nervous. That's a problem.
Okay.
Again, that was an inaccurate statement. The initiative does not allow, and it says it directly in the language, it doesn't allow for any interested person to challenge a general permit or a minor permit. That's only a concept within the major permitting process.
Within 30 days,
this is from the major permitting
section 16.05.899, reconsideration of determinations within 30
days. For a major permit.
No. I looked up every one of the sections. Within 30 days after the date of the determination of the commissioner under AS 16.05.871, which is status as anadromous status of water, and then under AS 16.05.875C, that's a determination that a minor permit applies. Next, AS 16.05.883, that's a determination on a minor permit issuance. 16.05.84D, that's the decision to issue a general permit. And then it finally gets to what you're saying, decision on a major permit. This reconsideration of determination applies to every decision made for every type of permit. It's not just for major permits.
Okay. I do have to say one more thing. It seems to me, tell me if I have this wrong, that your concern is that the terms aren't defined. The biggest concern I have is that proper protection of fish and game is a totally undefined term. Do you think that this is more vague than the current law?
There's multiple terms in this current proposal that are vague.
Do you know what proper protection of fish and game means? Because I don't. And when I'm...
Well, there are regulations already in place that help us define that. This doesn't have any, give us any sense or indication of what the regulations are going to be, how those are going to be drafted. I feel like we're deciding on something where there's so many other things that need to be decided in the process that we don't fully understand the implications, which is why I don't like something this complex and long to be part of a proposition. It should be something that's done through the legislative process. And I know you and other proponents have said that it did go to the legislature. It went to one session and it didn't get anywhere because, you know, there needed to be more dialogue before it was even introduced to get to a place where you can get support. I worked for 10 years on a legislative piece for Sea Alaska Corporation. We didn't even introduce something legislatively until 4 years after having discussions with multiple stakeholders throughout the region. Throughout the process of getting it done, I went to hundreds and hundreds of meetings in every one of our communities multiple times, met with environmental groups, met with fishermen, met with municipalities, with tribes. You have to do the groundwork to get buy-in to something this complicated and this important with our resources and our land base in Alaska. And that's what we did. I just feel like there's more work that could have been done on the ground to get some buy-in to this. Again, we're willing to be at the table to work on something because fisheries is important to all of us. And if anybody is using scare tactics, it's this. Even the name Stand for Salmon. You know, people are signing on to it because they feel like they have to, because we all support salmon. But I want people to understand, voting no on one doesn't mean you don't support salmon. It means you support a more balanced approach to addressing the salmon protection of salmon in our salmon habitat.
Okay. And we kind of got into a back and forth, so I can't remember. Did you get to answer the question, which was why aren't the current protections for salmon adequate?
Yeah, I mean, thanks for giving me the chance. I think my answer was in my response.
Yes. Okay.
To Jaylene.
All right. I just wanted to make sure that you had that.
We currently have one sentence that says we're going to do proper protection of fish and game, and like many Alaskans, I'm like, well, what does that mean? And I'm concerned that it gets to be decided behind closed doors, without any process, public participation, et cetera, and decided by one person who's basically a political appointee of the governor.
One concern that I've heard from more than one person is regarding the mitigation requirement, and they're concerned that they know that development will no longer be able to mitigate in another place. They have to mitigate in the stream that has been affected. Why was that put in, and can you talk a little bit about that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I mean, when you talk to fisheries biologists, they're going to talk to you about the resilience of salmon being based on the diversity of habitats and, you know, freshwater systems that salmon have to return to. And what history has shown us is that when you adopt a policy like offsite mitigation and you say, okay, we're going to let this river be dammed because we're going to go create a hatchery somewhere else, or we're going to let, this salmon system be buried under a mine tailings facility, and in exchange for that, you know, we'll go restore some habitat on Prince of Wales that was impacted somewhere else. It doesn't work. If you look, I mean, that policy has been tried and tested from the former salmon runs that used to exist in Europe on the east coast of the United States, and the now extinct and extremely severely declining runs from Washington, California, and Oregon, that all of the experts agree, like, you know, those runs are dying based on a death by a thousand cuts, you know, scenario in which river after river after river after river is being dammed, polluted, diverted, et cetera. And that system doesn't work for sustainable fisheries.
Okay. And then I'm going to guess you have a different point of view on that.
I just think that if you're going to do mitigation that improves somewhere, it doesn't have to be on that site, then that's good for overall, that's good. What I worry about is projects like an airport. An airport goes through a lot of reviews to figure out the placement and location and where it's going to be. If it's going to impact a waterway under this provision, how are they going to mitigate that particular stream if this runway is where it's going to be? You know, I figure like there's going to be some projects where there's no way to mitigate on site, which means then it can't go forward. I'm thinking about on Admiralty Island, where my community of Angoon, we still don't have a runway. They're trying to get a runway. They've been trying to place it multiple times, and now they've sort of agreed, hopefully. They've been working on this since I was a kid. And I'm not going to tell you how old I am, but they're working on that. If this passes, any impacts they have in Angoon, in a swampland, which is water, couldn't be mitigated elsewhere. It would have to be addressed right there in the airport, which can't be adjusted again. You know, I just feel like it's going to require a lot of going back to the drawing board or just essentially killing the projects. Mitigation at other locations is an option everywhere. We actually have a carbon project that Sea Alaska is doing that allows us to sell mitigation offsets for large companies. And I just think overall, that's just good for the environment to have those opportunities.
And I think what's good for salmon is to mitigate on site. And I think the example you gave is a perfect example of a situation in which on-site mitigation is possible, but not necessarily required. And that's the concern. You can, you know, alter a stream to flow around a project, a work, a diversion, a dam, a runway, what have you, and maintain that water body as salmon habitat. The problem is that right now the law doesn't say that that's what you have to do. It says you can mitigate off-site, you can pay the state a fee in lieu of mitigating, or you could build a hatchery to replace the salmon population that you damaged. And I think that's archaic and unacceptable for Alaska.
Well, I think under the current statutes, though, there's already defined anadromous salmon-bearing streams, rivers, waterways in Alaska, and people are already avoiding large projects on some of those waterways. What this proposition does is says that every waterway is potentially fish-bearing. That's a problem, unless you prove otherwise. It's like being guilty, and you have to prove your innocence. And, you know, I just don't like the thought of having to go through the process of, and who knows what it's going to take. Our salmon aren't in the streams year-round. Sometimes they're not even there for a couple years, and then they come back. So you have to camp somebody out there on the stream for 9 months, for 2 years, before you can get the certification that, yes, the commissioner can sign off that it's not anadromous. That's the problem, that everything is presumed to be fish-bearing, and that's not the case in Alaska.
I am kind of curious why the presumption of an anadromous fish stream is in place, unless it already has been surveyed and proven otherwise. Mm-hmm. Why was that included?
Oh, that's one of my favorite questions, because I think that's one of the biggest weaknesses in the current system. When we did become a state, the Department of Fish and Game was directed to issue fish habitat permits in any salmon-bearing, I'm using air quotes there, water bodies, right? And the commissioner had the discretion to sort of decide what their science told them were salmon-bearing water bodies. And when I talked to the old biologists who were around at the time, they said, we just assumed there were fish everywhere. And so we took the precautionary approach to development, and we assumed there were fish. We worked with developers as best we could to ensure that they had permits from us that included operations that were responsible. So at some point later on in our state's history, a bill was introduced that created the Anadromous Waters Catalog. And that sets up the system under which we're currently operating. And it said, nope, we're going to flip this thing on its head. We're going to say that the Department of Fish and Game doesn't have power to issue fish habitat permits in any salmon-bearing stream. In fact, they only have authority over waters that the Sport Fish Division determines are anadromous. And then that bill passed, and so ADF&G, the Department of Fish and Game's sort of authority over salmon-bearing streams in Alaska, was more than cut in half. The department estimates that right now in 2018, maybe 50% of our water bodies that have salmon in them are in the catalog. The catalog is the trigger for this Title 16 fish habitat permit. So if a water body isn't in the catalog, it doesn't matter if it has fish in it or not, you don't have to get a permit. And I think, again, like, let's be Alaskans. Let's be bold and brave and do this differently. Why would we take the cookie cutter approach that has led to the total destruction and extinction of salmon in so many other countries and states? Why would we do that? We have a chance to do it different and say, we're a salmon state. We are salmon people. We can see with our own eyes that basically if it's connected to saltwater, and there's not a waterfall or some giant physical barrier, this is what we're so blessed. There's going to be salmon. Let's protect them.
And I don't disagree with protecting salmon streams. And I think the Department of Fish and Game is regularly trying to update and add to and make sure that the index includes all the anadromous streams. I guess what I would say, too, is that the current regulations are very focused on the salmon. This proposition would deal with anadromous species. There's at least 19. Some have told me 24, 27. So this definitely expands the fisheries that would be protected when it's the salmon that they're focusing on and their information that they're dispersing. But it's actually going to protect other anadromous species that aren't as critical as the current regulations put on protecting the salmon habitat. So, you know, I don't know that how many people eat trout and lamprey and other things that are in the waterways, but to protect all those other species when our priority should be on the salmon, that's another area that would be different under this new regime.
I'd also like to add for listeners, I think it's really important to hear this, that another reason that we propose to create this presumption of anadromy is to save the state money. So right now, the cost burden is on the Department of Fish and Game to go out and survey streams reach by reach or mile by mile and prove with scientific methodology that salmon are there. That's their only way to get jurisdiction to protect those streams. And I'm like, you know, why does Alaska have to pay for that when these big, multinational corporations are the one coming in, taking the resources and profiting? So this sort of takes that burden of paying for all of that off of the Department of Fish and Game and says, hey, if you want to prove that there aren't fish in the stream, then you can absorb that cost because you're the one that's going to profit off of this. And Alaskans are the ones who profit from protecting salmon habitat.
But this isn't just for the big companies. What I worry about is the road projects in our villages. I worry about the new health clinics that have to go in. I worry about the new bridges that have to go in our communities. Those are Alaskans. Those are communities. Those are community projects. Those are basic infrastructure projects that now have to bear the additional cost. That's what I'm concerned about.
I do want to talk about costs a little bit because this would be a more rigorous permitting process. I got to assume there would be more cost to the state as a result. Jaylene, do you want to address that first and then we'll go to you?
Yes. There are additional steps that will have to occur with the presumption of an anadromous just being one point because of that presumption. There will be requests to the commissioner for every stream, every water that could be impacted by any kind of project or development, where they're going to have to request the commissioner to not find this to be anadromous. They'll have to send resources there to do a site check of the location and then write a report to say yes or no, there's fish there or there isn't there, and then go through the permitting process of figuring out, is there enough of an effect that this should be a major permit? Should this be a minor permit? Should we do a general permit for this area? And then also all the public hearing steps that are going to have to occur. Any interested party can request a public hearing on the plan for the project and also on the decision about the project. So I just think there's more steps every step of the way, not just for ADF&G, even the Department of Environmental Conservation, the Department of Transportation, they all have extra steps that they're going to have to take. We're in a budget crisis here in this state. And, you know, financially, this is going to cost the state a lot more money. And this often, unfortunately, comes off the back of our rural communities and also, you know, other important things like education. So I hope that we can direct our resources a little bit more wisely and not have to put in these extra steps that I think are not necessary.
And before you go, Lindsay, we haven't had any calls yet, so I want to put out a quick feeler there. We have a little less than 15 minutes left. If anybody does want to call with a question, now would be the time to do that, 225-9655 or 1-800-557-5723. Okay, go ahead, Lindsay.
Okay, so just to be clear, there is absolutely nothing in this ballot initiative that says additional costs of administration are going to come off the backs of rural communities. So I'm not sure, like, in what factuality that's based in, but it's certainly not written into the initiative. Another piece of this that I think is really important, and, you know, it's been a while since I had to write a business plan, but that's how I look at this. And, you know, salmon are a swimming permanent fund. They are a dividend that pays off to Alaska in the magnitudes of billions of dollars every year in our commercial fishing, sport fishing. People in Ketchikan here are very familiar with the tourism and charter fishing dollars that are spent in this town. And that's all income. So Jaylene's talking about costs that might be associated with administering the proposed initiative. But what we're not talking about and what we're not balancing that against is the savings. So like I said, there's going to be tremendous savings when Fish and Game no longer has to go out and try to get ahead of projects and survey and sample and prove what water bodies are and aren't anadromous. So I think that will be a huge savings. Another thing that I look at is we have concrete examples. Look at the state of Washington, for example. They have spent in the last 9 years $5.5 billion to try to restore salmon habitat. They have a restoration economy in the billions. And to me, that is going to be a cost that Alaskans will also incur, just like our neighbors to the south in the future, if we don't pay a little bit forward right now to ensure responsible development and proper protection.
Okay.
Oops, sorry.
That's all right. And I did have another question that was submitted to me ahead of time, and that is, who are the funding sources for each of the campaigns, Stand for Salmon and Stand for Alaska? And this time we'll go ahead and start with Lindsay.
Okay. It's kind of like a question that is comparing apples and hand grenades, right? Stand for Salmon has raised a bit over $1 million. I don't know what the last report was with the Alaska Public Offices Commission. I do know that over 1,000 Alaskans have contributed out of their pocket to the Stand for Salmon movement. And I also know that the top contributors right now are Alaskan-based nonprofit organizations. I don't even have the top three right in front of me. The Alaska Conservation Foundation, I know, is one of them. I saw today an ad. We're just starting to get some ads up and running that was paid for by the Tanana Chiefs Conference. I know we have received a pretty significant donation from the Kuskokwim Health Corporation. And there are some outside individuals as well who maybe they love eating salmon on their dinner plates, and there are customers here in Alaska, I'm not sure, but that have donated to the campaign. On the hand grenade side, you know, you've got, and Jaylene can talk to you about it more, but companies like ExxonMobil, Pebble Partnership, Donlin Gold, et cetera.
Well, yeah. we'll let Jaylene answer that.
Yes, we do have large companies that provide thousands of jobs in Alaska that are contributing to this effort. Yes, we have ConocoPhillips and large companies that will be affected by this, and the jobs that they provide that will be affected by this. So they have contributed. And then we have many Native corporations, Alaska Native corporations, that own 44 million acres of land within Alaska that will be impacted. The Native self-determination of their land use will be impacted. So we do have at least 450 businesses, small business owners, large business owners, individuals who've contributed that are from Alaska that provide jobs to Alaskans that have contributed to this. You know, we have, and I appreciate you answering my question for me, but there are donors of theirs that they won't name and specify that don't live in Alaska, that aren't based here, large millionaires from back east, and I don't know why they can't just answer the question. And it actually went to an APOC hearing recently because of it.
If anybody wants to know who the donors are on either side of the issue, it is required by law that they be reported to the Alaska Public Offices Commission. It is mm-hmm. all public information. I encourage any listeners who want to find out for themselves to look it up on that website.
And I encourage you to look at the transcript of the recent APOC hearing that questioned the reporting done by Stand for Salmon and how inadequate it was.
And we do have somebody on the line, so if you want to put your headphones on so you can hear the question. It is Catherine here in Ketchikan. Catherine, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Yes. Please go ahead with your question.
My question is really for Jaylene, because at the beginning of this debate, I heard her say her concern was over her private property. And I, over this campaign, I just have really felt just a little bit of her loyalty was not really as concerned over private property. Is it true that you're really more concerned for the major outside corporations such as big oil and mining?
No, that's never been my position or even Sea Alaska's position. Yes, this will impact big companies and big projects, but our concern overall is the impact on our rural communities and community infrastructure projects, whether it's hydro projects, other energy projects, housing projects, road projects. Those are the big concerns that we have that can't afford the additional costs and delays that will result from this proposition. And then just as an individual citizen, yes, you know, we should all be concerned about impacts on our private property and having to get permits for little projects we do on our own property. But I am more concerned about rural community development projects and infrastructure projects.
So your loyalties are not to the outside multinational corporations.
No, my loyalties are here as an Alaskan and our communities. I grew up in Angoon, a rural community that still doesn't have an airport. And the impacts of this on that project that's still ongoing, I'm pretty frightened for that.
Okay. Thank you, Catherine, for your question. And we're going to have to go to the next person on the phone. And that is Jill. So, Jill, go ahead with your question.
Hi. I just... Well, it's not really a question. I just wanted to thank Stand for Salmon because we do have the last healthy fish stocks in the entire world. So it's about time that we save it and our, you know, do what we can to protect what we can. Our own representative last night on KRBD's Dan Ortiz said that this had to happen by public initiative because the legislature would not address adequate salmon protection. And also, I do have a question. Doesn't this only last for 2 years before it has to be, signed into law?
I think no. With the initiative process, correct me if I'm wrong, after 2 years, the legislature can change it significantly. Mm-hmm. I think that is what happens with the initiative process. So it would become law, and then after 2 years, the legislature could adjust it or repeal it, I believe.
That's correct.
Yes.
Right. So why don't we just try this at this last-ditch effort to save something on this planet? For 2 years, it doesn't seem like it's asking for much at all. And that's my comment. And thank you for all doing this.
All right. Thank you very much, Jill.
Jill, this is Lindsay with Stand for Salmon, and I think what you said is really important in terms of the urgency of this. Jaylene talked earlier about, you know, why can't we create focus groups and collaborative processes and go to every village in Alaska, and you talked about the 10 years that it had taken to create legislation, in a previous situation. And I think I want to say, like, this law, unlike most of the other laws on the books in the state, hasn't been touched in the last 60 years. And we don't have time. We don't have 10, 15, another generation of Alaskans to wait while our salmon habitat doesn't have adequate protections to get to some kind of, you know, giant statewide consensus.
And I do think that there's other former state regulators and current regulators who believe that we are science-based, that we are what other states and even countries look to as the model for maintaining and protecting our fisheries. And again, I'm not saying that there aren't areas for improvement. Everything can be improved in all facets of our statutory and regulations up here in Alaska. But this particular proposal is not the way to go about it. It's too imbalanced and too focused on one set of interests and not looking at other parts of the Alaskan economy.
And we did have somebody who didn't want to go on the air, and the question and or statement is, salmon are not returning to the streams. The ocean is the bigger problem. Is it really protection of the streams that's the issue? Can we address that?
Yeah. I mean, I think we've both mentioned that we agree with the fact that the ocean conditions, the warming oceans, the acidifying oceans, and everything unknown going on in the oceans is probably a significant factor. It's conclusively a significant factor in the low returns of salmon. But, you know, I've been thinking about it as, like, we can't really control, you know, on a global scale, everything that's going into and going on in the oceans. Alaska has the jurisdiction to control what happens in our water bodies in our state. And this is where our salmon come to incubate, to spawn, to rear. And I kind of think of it as, like, you know, telling a woman to go ahead and smoke while she's pregnant because the outside environment's going to be contaminated as well. It's like, let's do what we can. Let's control the things we can. And let's keep our water bodies, our rivers, our streams, our lakes that support our salmon as healthy as we can, because we know that they're going to need that in order to survive and to be resilient to what's going on out in the ocean where we don't have total control.
But you're correct. Whoever provided the question, thank you. A lot of the scientists, and I was at a recent environmental conference that was hosted by our Tlingit and Haida Indian tribes in Juneau, and they did talk about the impacts of the ocean and the acidity temperatures in the ocean and the impacts on the salmon, and not as much on the streams. Our streams and anadromous water bodies are healthy, and I feel like we're doing over control, over regulation in an area that is not even the source of the problem.
Okay, and I do want to apologize to those who called in who we were not able to get to. We're running out of time, so we're going to have to close things down very shortly. And did you have a closing statement that you wanted to make? Lindsay, you want to start?
Sure, I can start with that. I mean, I think that there's a lot. I'm heartened that I think that there's a lot in this discussion that we've all agreed on. And one of the things we all agree on is that, you know, Alaska is, it can no longer be in denial that, that there is a problem going on with our salmon. But the good news is that we are not so far gone when it comes to losing salmon that it can't be addressed. We have the benefit of hindsight in Alaska. We can look at the lower 48 and we can predict what's going to happen if we do nothing. We also have that silver lining where we have the opportunity to get it right. And a strong fish habitat protection law is going to enable Alaska to plan for a future that will promote smart and responsible economic growth and maintain our state's commitment to the sustainability and health of our salmon resources. My hope for our future, that I believe is shared by most Alaskans, is that we can learn from the past and choose a different path. We can resist those who make claims that protecting one of our most treasured resources is somehow anti-Alaskan. There is nothing more Alaskan, I think, than protecting our salmon runs for future generations. That's really about as Alaskan as it gets. I encourage people who are still undecided to continue to do their homework. I think the dialogue is incredible. I'm so grateful for our democratic process and the ability of the citizens of Alaska to bring an issue like this forward and to vet it through ourselves and through the public. And I hope that you'll join me in going to the ballot on November 6th and voting yes, because our salmon really deserve nothing less than that. Thank you.
Thank you, Lindsay Bloom and Jaylene Kukesh.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for giving us an opportunity to educate the voters. And above all, everybody out there, get out there and vote. Use your voice and vote. I do want to say that we all support salmon. We all support its importance to our people. But I do want you to look past the name of this coalition and this initiative, Stand for Salmon, and read the fine print. Go through the 8 pages. If you don't understand it, call somebody who understands it. Call me, and I'll explain to you what it means. I just feel that this initiative has unintended consequences to our communities and our economy, and for that reason, I'll be voting no on one, and I encourage others to do the same. And again, we would gladly participate in any process that actually deals with the problems that might be out there that provides an opportunity to get insight and input from those with traditional knowledge, from scientists, from regulators, from those with experience, from people in our communities, from businesses, from all facets, not just from commercial harvesters, from all aspects of our state, to get a balanced approach to addressing this very important issue.
Okay, thank you both for being here.
Thank you, Lila.
We have recorded this entire forum. We'll be putting that on our website in the next couple of days, and we also will add the full ballot initiative as well, so people could read that in its entirety. So that is it for KRBD's special election coverage featuring representatives from Stand for Salmon and Stand for Alaska. I've been your host, Layla Carey. Thanks so much for our guests, Lindsay Bloom and Jaylene Kukesh, who traveled here to help us understand this important issue. I hope it cleared things up for some folks. And please remember to vote on November 6th.